Welcome to Pick Me Up, I'm Scared, the podcast.
I'm your host, Madeline.
And I'm your co-host, Kenna.
Okay, Kenna, today I wanted to start by asking you, when you were a kid, did you ever wish for like a really subtle superpower? Not like a big one, like you could fly or like walk through walls or be invisible, but like something just a little more practical.
Oh my gosh. I don't think I literally ever thought about it. I think like the closest thing to a superpower would be like, this is kind of embarrassing, but I was really in for a second, really into like the Anne of Green Gables books.
Oh, me too.
And like, I read all of those and all the Wizard of Oz series, which is like, they're weird. But anyway, but I think what I would wish for would be to be like alone, like, and be more like insightful and special and magical, or like Anne of Green Gables and be like a good writer. So superpower, maybe the power of being more interesting than the other little kids in my small town, which now I'm like, wow, that was so narcissistic and also a sad, lonely Kenny.
It's cute though. I get where it comes from. You're like, I feel alone. What if I could be alone in a special way?
So maybe like the power of communication.
Oh, maybe.
I think that was it. I think maybe I still wish for that I wish my superpower was to actually be a good communicator than a weird one.
I appreciate you being a weird communicator. Oh, I like you. It. Okay, so I think about this sometimes because when I was a kid, I had like a really weird superpower that I became like fixated on that I'm like, this one's not even that big. Like I could have this one. It seems more realistic. It was not realistic, but it was that I had a magic wallet and every time I would open it, there would be $20 in it.
Oh.
Very specific. And I'm like, $20 isn't that much money, but it's enough to get whatever you need. You know, you're out, you're hungry, $20 in the wallet. Like, you got to put gas in your car, $20 in the wallet.
So would it be every time you open it? So if you opened it like 100 times in a day, you'd have $200? Because that's what I would be doing. Like, my job for 8 hours a day would just be opening and closing that wallet.
No, I think the way I thought about it was that every time you opened it, a $20 bill would be in it.
Oh.
So you would have to remove it. So I guess theoretically, yeah, you could run a money mill off of the magic wallet.
Oh my God. You're all blistered from opening and closing.
Yeah, yeah. You could open it, take the money out, close it. Open it, take the money out. See, but I would not have abused it. That's why in my head, it would have been a really realistic superpower to have. Because you're like, this isn't even that big of a deal, right?
Oh my gosh, at certain points in my life, I would definitely wanted that superpower.
Right,
okay. I mean, actually, like, just up until recently, yes, I would.
Yes. So now, as an adult, there's actually a macroeconomic theory that's kind of the same thing as my childhood magic wallet. Do you know what it is?
Is it modern monetary theory?
It is modern monetary theory, yes.
What do I win? Do I win $20?
You win $20.
Yay.
Yeah, so given the recent news that the U.S. government is set to run out of money by October 18th, if Congress doesn't raise the debt ceiling, I thought it would be a great time to do an episode on what modern monetary theory is.
Ooh.
So starting out, you're familiar with the thing about the government running out of money. Did you see this?
I saw that, and it seems like from time to time, you see this on the news or hear it on the radio where they're like, if they run out of money, like, basically shit's gonna hit the fan and no more government. And you're like, okay.
Yeah, pretty much.
I don't quite understand. You're just like, oh, okay.
Yeah, so the U.S. government has been spending on average around $50 billion per day. And the Treasury Department has been warning for a little while that at this rate, you know, like, we're going to run out of money at some point in generally, no, October. Now, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen is worried that the U.S. could default on its debt in just a couple of weeks. We've like hit the magic money time and they're like, yeah, October 18th is the day. That's all we can do. And the tweets about this are so funny.
Oh my gosh. I think I saw one that was like, you don't have 6 months worth of savings.
Yes. People were telling the government to get a better paying job. Someone told the government to apply at McDonald's. Someone said to stop getting Starbucks every day. People were saying the Capitol building was going to get turned into a spirit Halloween.
Stop eating your avocado toast, government.
Yes, someone said OnlyFans.gov. which is a bummer because they couldn't even do that if they wanted to anymore. And then someone said they should Airbnb the White House for passive income, which honestly, that one seems the most realistic. I'm kind of surprised our government doesn't do that already.
I'm surprised you couldn't just be like, I'm going to rent out the Oval Office for $20,000.
Right? Like if we're capitalisming, that seems inevitable, but I guess it's a security issue too. I don't know. But it is pretty funny, and it made me think about some things I've done at my brokest, you know, like, oh, maybe the government needs some broke kid tips. And like my thing I've done at my brokest is that I once had this chair that for some reason in my house had some sort of value. I found it on the side of the street, but every time I would be short on rent, I would put the chair in the back of my car and drive it to a pawn shop and pawn the chair. And then by the end of the month, I would always get the chair back. But then like come the next month, I'd be broke again and I would go pawn the pawn chair. It just existed to be pawned and give me money basically when I needed. What about you? Like, what were your like broke tips?
Well, I sold vintage. So basically I would go to the buy the pound vintage places with like $5. Take it to like a Buffalo Exchange, make it into like $15, like buy food and then have like something out and like $5 worth of gas. And then the next day I had $5. So it was just like turning five into 15. Like,
yes. So I did something similar, but mine is more sketchy and illegal. So I used to go to like Crossroads or Buffalo Exchange, and I would try on all the designer clothes and I'd bring a seam ripper with me. And then once I was in the fitting room, I would seam rip off all the designer tags and just leave the clothes. So I'd steal all the tags that said like Marc Jacobs on them or whatever. Then I would go to like the thrift or like the pay by the pound, and I would get like Forever 21 like stuff, you know, for like 25, 50 cents. And I would take it all home, cut the tags out, sew the Marc Jacobs tags in, and then go back to Crossroads and sell them the fake designer goods I'd made.
You can't see the look on my face, but I used to work buying at a vintage buy-sell trade, and this is specifically why we would double tag the designer labels into, we would like put the security tags inside the label because that was a problem.
I was people a pioneer. Is what you're labels. Telling me. I was a pioneer in my field.
I was like, you were the one, you were the reason why I had to double tag everything.
I was indeed.
But
I
also
was
I'm just like,
really
good
brick.
For you.
Yeah.
Who cares?
Okay. So yeah, anyway, how did our government get here? If not via drinking Starbucks and taking Ubers everywhere, because I don't think that's how the government ran out of money. Well, most recently by a vote on Monday, September 27th, where Senate Republicans struck down a bill that would suspend the federal debt limit and avoid a total government shutdown. Well, Democrats control 50 seats in the Senate. They would have needed 60 votes to suspend the debt limit, meaning they would have needed to recruit 10 Republicans on their side. And that just like didn't happen. So economists are worried, yes, that this could have potentially catastrophic economic results. Markets could stagnate. There could be huge pay delays for American public services. Interest rates could skyrocket, all sorts of bad stuff. And basically, the U.S. currently has $28.43 trillion of national debt. There is a federal debt limit or cap at $28.4 trillion, meaning basically if the U.S. had a credit card, it would be maxed the fuck out. So the entire U.S. GDP last year, by comparison, was $20.9 trillion. So the U.S. government does run a pretty significant budget deficit every year, spending more than it brings in. And this means that the government needs to borrow money every year to finance its operating expenses. That amount that we're short every year is called the deficit, which, of course, if you grow up in the United States, you probably hear people talking about the deficit vaguely in the background like your whole life. In 2021, we ran a budget deficit of $3 trillion. For reference, the U.S. military budget is nearly $1 trillion alone, which we talked about in a different episode. So it is constitutionally granted that if the U.S. wants to borrow money, it has to be authorized by Congress. However, in the early 20th century, the Treasury got pretty over asking for permission like each time it needed to issue bonds to pay bills. So the debt limit was introduced, creating an amount of money they were allowed to spend without needing specific congressional approval each time. The first debt limit came as part of the Second Liberty Bond Act of 1917, and a general limit on the federal debt was imposed in 1939. And the way that the Treasury borrows money is through this thing called a Treasury bond, which is a debt security the government owns. I'd heard a lot about bonds, but I've never fully understood them. But they are considered to be pretty low risk investments, and they can be bought by pretty much anyone, even including just like the average person. So that's why 78% of the national debt in the US is actually owned just by the public, and 22% is intra-government holdings. So that last part, the intra-governmental debt, is just when the Treasury owes money to other federal agencies. And a big part of that is Social Security, paying, you know, the meager retirement payouts to the public that we all get that we won't be able to live off of. They end up owning a huge amount of the national debt. Social Security takes in more revenue from taxes than it needs, and it uses the surplus in its own budget to invest in Treasury bonds. Medicare is also an example of another government agency that owns some of the Treasury debt. And as for the public debt, that's owned in part by foreign governments. I know, like, the news is always talking about, like, China. We owe China all the money. So actually, Japan owns $1.28 trillion of U.S. debt, and China owns $1.06 trillion. U.S. banks and investors, state and local governments, and insurance companies also own a large portion of our public debt. By comparison, Social Security trusts own $2.9 trillion, though. So it's actually not that weird myth about, like, China basically owning the United States, or however weird xenophobes, like, say it and cry it from their towers. Basically, the debt's pretty evenly spread around a lot of places, and a lot of it is just back to our own government in different ways. And all this creates a situation where some people are really concerned about balancing the U.S. budget to avoid that annual deficit or debt. And this ties in with why lots of Republicans don't want to raise the debt ceiling. They're like, balance out the budget instead. But this is just kind of this politicizing rallying cry, because for many years, it was simply routine to raise the U.S. debt ceiling whenever it was needed. And the reality is that a lot of other countries don't deal with this at all. Most countries have no debt limit whatsoever, and places like Denmark have a debt limit, but it's so high that it doesn't actually need to be raised, like, hardly ever in practice. However, as US culture becomes increasingly more politicized, the issue of overspending became kind of a convenient theatrical talking point for Republicans and Democrats to fight with each other over. And politicians and economists have been trying to circumvent the need to deal with the debt ceiling issue altogether with, like, what they consider fringe economic ideas. So after leaving office, Barack Obama acknowledged that he and the Treasury officials considered alternatives like minting one single $1 trillion coin to pay off some of the national debt. Have you heard of that?
I've heard about this in, like, some, like, I think it was like a Planet Money podcast where they, like, kind of broke it down, but they're like, we could make one coin to end them all.
Yeah. Basically. So in a 2017 interview, Barack Obama described the idea as wacky, and the Biden administration rejected the idea again just last week, actually. But lots of other people describe ideas like this, which are just outside the mainstream schools of economic theory, with this term called heterodox economics, which is basically just saying anything outside of, like, the mainstream neoclassical model of economics, which says supply and demand are the driving factors behind production, pricing, and consumption, or Keynesian economics, which says the government can employ techniques of quantitative easing for, like, lowering interest rates, things like that, to increase demand and boost economic growth. So those are the two pretty commonplace economic models we think of, and anything that falls outside of that, we're like heterodox economics. But Keynesian economics actually started as kind of a heterodox economic theory on its own until it was widely implemented in the 1930s and accepted. So this term is kind of relative and just encompasses theories that aren't really mainstream at the time. So while the $1 trillion coin seemed wacky, right, to Barack Obama and now again to the Biden administration, it's just because it's a really new idea, not because it necessarily lacks merit altogether. And modern monetary theory is an example of an economic theory now considered heterodox, but it's gaining some interest.
It sounds just cool to me.
Heterodox or?
No, the idea of a $1 trillion coin.
Oh, yeah. Can you imagine the heist movie? The ultimate heist, that's a $1 trillion coin.
I'm imagining a sci-fi heist movie. Or, like, you know, on QVC where they show the, like, the commemorative coin.
Yes.
There's, like, a QVC ad that's, like, the commemorative $1 trillion coin. And, of course, they probably put someone really fucked up on it.
Yeah, they could do that, and then they could sell it to the person who wins capitalism, and that's their prize. They're like, you get this, you give us your $1 trillion, you get your $1 trillion, you won capitalism prize.
They're holding it up like a WWF belt.
Yes, exactly.
Or sorry,
yes.
WWE.
Oh, did they change the name?
Yes, we are old.
Oh, God, I don't even know. Yeah, so basically, modern monetary theory says that monetarily sovereign countries like the US, the UK, Japan, Canada, which spend, tax, and borrow in a fiat currency, which is just a government-issued currency that's not backed by a commodity, like gold. Like, it's not tied to gold, right? It just has value because we said it has value. That's the dollar. As long as they operate with, like, a fiat currency that they fully control, are not operationally constrained by revenues when it comes to federal government spending, like this whole debt ceiling thing we've been dealing with. Modern monetary theory is, like, if you're doing that, why do you need to worry about how much money there is or isn't? So this basically means that under modern monetary theory, I know that's going to be a tongue twister this whole episode, the governments who print their own money could potentially just keep printing money, like, as much as they need.
In my brain, whenever you're talking about, like, all the money, and then they do this with the money, and I'm like, it's all fake, though.
And it is all fake. But it is also the magic wallet idea applied to a government.
I know.
And it's similar to the magic wallet idea, too, because it's not like you're just spending gratuitously. It's like for things you actually need mm-hmm. that theoretically would bolster the economy. So traditional economic theory says that just creating more money would cause inflation to skyrocket. That's what you always hear, right? Making things just cost more and more proportionally to meet the influx of the new money supply. But modern monetary theory says that a government's economy is not like you're running a household budget. And when you zoom out and look big picture, spending isn't actually that big of a deal for a sovereign nation at all. So modern monetary theory, MMT is what we're going to call it for now. It explains that large government debt isn't the precursor to collapse that we've been led to believe it is. Countries like the US can sustain much greater deficits without cause for concern at all. And a small deficit or surplus can be extremely harmful and cause a recession, since deficit spending is what builds people's savings. This is because modern monetary theorists say that debt already is money in our economy. It's just money that the government put into circulation and didn't tax back. While inflation could be an unwanted byproduct of increased spending, MMT says that it can be combated with policy decisions by the government whenever required, and that honestly, inflation might not actually happen at all anyway. So MMT states that the only real spending limit a government has are its resources that they can't just print more of. So things like workers, construction supplies, that kind of thing. So if the government were to spend too much in terms of these things, inflation could definitely surge because demand outweighs supply. However, printing money to match demand might not have any effect whatsoever. And while traditional economic theory says taxes have a vital role in providing the government with the spending money they need to build infrastructure and fuel programs, MMT actually says that taxes create an ongoing demand for currency and can be a tool instead to remove money out of an economy if inflation starts creeping in. So this is kind of like the opposite of how people usually think of taxes, right? Because you usually think, like, I pay my taxes and then my taxes go and they fund all the things that I want our government to have. And a lot of things I don't want our government to have, but apparently I don't get to decide that. But in MMT, what they're saying instead is, like, no, the government prints the money for all the things it wants to do. And then if it looks like inflation might start to be an issue, it comes back and taxes the people to kind of balance out and remove money from the general circulation to make sure inflation doesn't occur. And MMT says that whole business the Treasury has of selling bonds to finance its debt is kind of roundabout and pointless, since the Treasury could just print the money on its own. MMT also says that unemployment is the result of the government spending too little in an economy while still collecting taxes. So if people looking for work were able to find a job in the private sector and weren't able to find a job in the private sector, MMT is like, okay, let's just give them minimum wage transition jobs funded by the government and managed by the local community. This labor would act as buffer stock to help the government control inflation in the economy. And American economist Warren Mosler helped develop MMT, and he's kind of one of the most popular figures in the movement because he started getting a lot of these ideas out on the internet pretty early on. And he explains that, quote, when you pay taxes, the money is literally destroyed. If you pay by check, they debit your account and those funds are gone, just like shutting off a light switch. If you somehow paid with actual cash and old paper bills, they would send them to be shredded. You can buy shredded dollars online. So already we see taxes moving money from circulation. The difference is that taxation policy would be crafted with this in mind to balance out any inflation that might occur. So modern monetary theorists actually fully acknowledge this potential for like runaway hyperinflation. However, taxation policy is their proposal on how to address it. After all, the government has to create the money first in order to spend it, and only after it's in circulation can it be taxed back, which makes kind of sense, right? The government can create its own money. The government creates money in order to spend it. Taxes make the money valuable because a government can create all the money it wants, and it can also tax back all the money it wants, keeping prices stable. And the government need not balance its books the way your house does. So according to Business Insider, governments create and spend money, but they do not tax back 100% of that cash. That's why at any given time, a government will be running a deficit. The deficit is merely the difference between all the cash the government has spent and all the taxes it's collected. A deficit signifies that the private sector, you and me, is holding the difference. So if the government is in deficit, the flip side is that the private sector is in surplus. Similarly, if the government is in surplus, it must mean that the private folks are in deficit, using debt or their savings to get by, because total payments to the government are more than the government spending. From this perspective, deficits aren't the problem, they're the solution. The alternative is squeezing the economy in order to balance the government's books. And that makes no sense if the government has the ability to create new cash and wipe away its own deficits anytime it wants without raising taxes. I thought that was pretty interesting, right?
Yeah.
I like that explanation. MMT advocates instead say there's just a natural bias against deficits, which has been hyper-politicized, but it isn't actually founded in much of reality at all. And Mosler, the guy who kind of helped put this idea out there and was spreading around on the internet pretty early on, was actually inspired by older schools of economic theory like functional finance and, oh, this is going to be another one that my high school AP European history teacher said with a weird accent, and I don't know if it was right or not. Not a weird accent. I think she was Swiss. Swiss people aren't weird. I'm sorry. Chartalism? Have you heard of this? Chartalism? That's how we were taught it?
Huh.
Okay.
My brain goes to Charlatans UK.
Okay,
but,
no.
So no.
Okay. So I'll explain both of them. Functional finance was a theory developed during World War II by Abba Lerner, which states that the government's focus should be on trying to balance supply and demand at full employment rather than balancing the budget by promoting deficit spending to reduce unemployment, controlling consumer spending through tax policy, and controlling interest rates, inflation, and the cash flow through the economy. Sounds pretty familiar, right? Sounds mm-hmm. a lot like MMT, modern monetary theory. Chartalism is the economic theory developed by German economist George Friedrich Knapp around 1905, which states that money is a unit of account with a value that is determined by what the government will accept as payment for tax obligations. So chartalism argues that money does not have intrinsic value, but is given value by the government. This theory kind of proved to be the basis for eliminating the gold standard, where money used to be used to represent like ownership of a literal hunk of gold, and then switching it over to the pure fiat currency we have in the US today, where the money just has value itself by virtue of existing and being money. But we now actually see cryptocurrency emerging in contrast to this kind of idea, since the government isn't really accepting cryptocurrency as payment for tax obligations. But some of the ideas behind chartalism and functional finance persevered and made their way into MMT. So we got this guy, Warren Mosler. He's thinking all about this in the 1970s, and he's working as a trader on Wall Street. In the 1990s, investors were worried that the economy of Italy would collapse due to government default on debt, kind of like what everyone's saying is going to happen here in the U.S. on October mm-hmm. 18th. However, Mosler realized that this just kind of didn't have to happen because the government would have to like declare itself null and void for this to actually occur, and it's just not going to do that. So his firm actually invested a lot of money in Italian bonds when everybody else was running away from them, because they were like, these Italian bonds are going to have no value because Italy's going to collapse. And he was like, no, we're going to buy a bunch because Italy's not going to collapse. And of course, the government did not default, and they actually made $100 million in profit from that. So this kind of got him thinking more about like the nature of what it means for like a government to collapse. And in 1993, he published an essay called Soft Currency Economics and shared it online, where he found other economists like Australian Bill Mitchell who agreed. So this theory kind of circulated around the internet and picked up steam and prompted conversations about things like the $1 trillion coin, among other things. And this is kind of how MMT was born. However, it's obviously been met with some criticisms. I'm sure you've heard criticisms of it, have you?
Yeah, basically, I feel like the main one is inflation.
That's the one I hear a lot too. So Nobel Prize winning economist Paul Krugman actually has money views on US debt that are pretty similar to MMT, but still strongly opposes MMT on the whole, warning that the US would, yes, see hyperinflation if it was put into practice and investors refused to buy US bonds. He also speculates that running huge deficits could lead banks to refuse to lend at reasonable interest rates, creating an unsustainable amount of debt, sparking inflation as the price of credit rises and investors flee. There's this other guy, Michael R. Strain, who's the resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, who also critiques MMT's proposal that taxes can be used to reduce inflation. According to him, he says, raising taxes would only make a downturn worse, increasing unemployment and further slowing the economy. Additionally, there's a whole leftist critique of MMT as well. While modern monetary theory is often classified with leftist economic policies like socialism and communism, it's actually just more left-leaning than truly leftist. It's more like an economic theory that could still exist within capitalism, similar to the Keynesian notions of regulation. This is probably why some more progressive Democrats like Bernie Sanders and AOC favor modern monetary theory. While capitalism has always used the threat of unemployment to drive down wages and mistreat workers, MMT doesn't necessarily compete with capitalism because the government can create jobs that the private sector has no interest in. The private sector is bad already at building things like roads, bridges, railways, airports, things we actually need, you know, probably because the private sector doesn't actually care about people, it cares about profit. And then what MMT says is like, well, the government will just come in and build those things instead so we don't interfere with what the private sector has going on. Additionally, a way in which MMT conflicts with like socialism, Marxism, forms of communism is that the government can employ labor at a minimum wage with the expressed goal of the private sector being able to outbid the government whenever it wants to lure away workers, which from a socialist or communist perspective actually makes MMT less appealing because it upholds capitalism's private sector as king and does not consider the workers' best interests first and foremost. While MMT can provide a social safety net that has long been lacking in capitalist USA, it makes these low-wage government jobs sound like they're replicating the exploitative labor conditions of capitalism, with one of the intentions being that the job is paid so well that the goal is for private sector to lure you to a different job. However, proponents maintain that much like the Fed today regulates inflation through interest rates, inflation could be similarly regulated through taxes and employment. So that argument, there's a lot of explanation around that, and it's a key focus of MMT and part of what's built into its structure. Even traditional economists have revealed that, yeah, the government probably could just print more money and it would be fine. In 2005, former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan told Congress, quote, "There's nothing to prevent the federal government creating as much money as it wants in payment to somebody," end quote. He explained that the only problem would be if there was enough resources or assets in existence to support all of the purchases the extra cash would demand. So for example, if you want to give everybody $500 to go buy a TV, that wouldn't be the problem, unless there weren't enough TVs for everyone to buy and not enough workers making TVs to meet the demand. That would kind of throw off the whole economy because now you have this huge demand for TVs, but not enough TVs, and that would affect the cost of things. In 2018, Goldman Sachs had an analyst say, "A sovereign debt crisis is difficult to imagine in a country that issues debt in its own currency, has flexible exchange rate, and controls its own central bank," which is basically what modern monetary theory is saying. In 2009, former Fed Chair Ben Bernanke was explaining how the Fed printed $1 trillion to help bail out banks in the 2008 financial crisis. He said, "The banks have accounts with the Fed, much the same way you have account in a commercial bank. So to lend to a bank, we simply use the computer to mark up the size of the account that they have with the Fed. It's much more akin to printing money than it is to borrowing." When the person interviewing him kind of balked at this and was like, "Oh, so you've been printing money," he responded by saying, "Well, effectively, and we need to do that because our economy is very weak and inflation is very low." And yet, following this influx of $1 trillion in new money, the U.S. government saw no inflation. The Fed lowered interest rates close to zero in order to counter deflation instead. This is probably also why countries like Japan, who run a government debt of nearly 240% their total GDP, haven't really experienced runaway inflation either. There's a deficit there, so clearly the government is spending more than it has. However, the current inflation rate in Japan is actually negative. This is why MMT argues that inflation is not caused by printing new money alone, and instead by a lack of goods, labor, or capacity. And we all know that the key to pulling out of a recession in capitalism historically has always been government spending. We had the FDR fireside chats and the New Deal following the Depression. We had stimulus checks come out during COVID. So the question is, why does the government stop short of continuing to spend until there is absolutely no unemployment whatsoever? If implemented correctly, MMT could grow the economy to its full capacity, enrich the private sector, eliminate unemployment, and finance major programs like universal healthcare, free college tuition, and green energy by just spending whatever it takes until it runs out of workers. The government could just funnel money into the economy, drive businesses to hire more people, and consumers to demand more goods and services. The existence of unemployment is clear de facto evidence that net government spending is too small to move the economy to full employment, wrote Phil Armstrong of York College in 2015. The government must use its position as a monopoly issuer of currency to ensure full employment. And that full employment, if failed to be reached by the private sector, would be reached by a job guarantee through government-funded jobs to absolutely anyone who wants or needs one, which is pretty similar to what Roosevelt did with the New Deal to help pull Americans out of unemployment by investing a lot of funds into building new infrastructure around the country following the Great Depression. Do you remember that? They were just like, mm-hmm. We'll build a bridge. We'll build a port.
Yeah, the Fullerton Post Office, you'll see like a New Deal mural. It's very pretty.
Oh, nice. Yeah. I mean, today too, our policies could be employed similarly to help assist infrastructure in the U.S. Like our infrastructure is kind of crumbling here, as well as social programs and like green repairs to existing government, you know, holdings, like whether it be like buildings or programs or roads. So, you know, we exist kind of now in the state where more than 25% of bridges in the United States need significant repairs or are handling more traffic than they were designed to carry.
Oh, I think about that. What was it, like Minneapolis bridge collapse?
Yes. Oh. Yeah, over 4,000 dams in America were deemed unsafe by the American Society of Civil Engineers. More than a third of all dam failures or near failures since 1874 have happened just in the last decade alone. Nearly a third of all highway fatalities are related to substandard road conditions, obsolete road designs, or roadside hazards. It's estimated that over one third of America's major roads are in poor or mediocre condition.
Potholes in LA, dude.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I've told this story before online, but I lived in Koreatown and there were so many potholes here in Los Angeles and Koreatown. And I would pop my tire sometimes driving down Western Street. And I remember I popped my tire one day driving down Western Street, had to call AAA, had to get a new tire put on my car, whatever, was late to work. It was really stressful. The next day, I'm driving down Western Street again, hit the exact same pothole, pop my tire again.
Oh.
But it's like the only way to get to my work. I have to pass this pothole. And it was just so upsetting. And then I started dating somebody who lived in a richer part of town, lived in Laurel Canyon. And I remember going to his house for the first time with him, and he was like, "Ugh, it's so annoying. They're repaving our streets again. Like they just did it 8 months ago." And that's like when I realized, I'm like, they're paving your streets every 8 months? Like they haven't repaved streets in Koreatown in like a decade.
Oh my God.
They won't fill potholes. They won't do any of this. There was this one major pothole by my house when I lived in Koreatown where somebody just stuck a cone in it because it was so huge and the city didn't do anything for forever. So somebody on my street was just like, "People need to know," and put a giant cone in it. And the cone just lived in the pothole for months.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, there's this one pothole where you get off the 101 exit to, I think, Silver Lake Boulevard near Virgil Village.
Yes.
That has the most brutal pothole.
Yeah. Like, our roads, especially in low-income communities, our roads are just toasted. They're horrible. And then, you know, the people with the money, obviously, they have all the nice roads. So they're like, "I don't see the problem. The roads are fine. Why do we need to fix the roads?"
Also, I feel like that SNL sketch, the Californians being like, "Yeah, you gotta avoid this pothole on like Silver Lake Boulevard. Then you take the 101 and then do blah, blah, blah."
Yes. So by 2035, highway usage and shipping by truck is expected to double, leaving Americans to spend an average of 160 hours a year in traffic on these substandard roads. And traffic jams are caused by poor transit infrastructure, and they cost Americans 4 billion hours and nearly 3 billion gallons of gasoline a year. We also have America's aging sewer systems, which spill an estimated 1.26 trillion gallons of untreated sewage every single year. I did not know that was happening. That's horrifying. And in 2005, U.S. infrastructure earned a D rating from the American Society of Civil Engineers. This was down from a D+ in 2001 and 2003. So by 2020, every major U.S. container port is also projected to be handling at least double the volume it was designed for, and railroads are expected to need over $200 billion in investment through 2035. And then you have things like education. 30 years ago, America was the leader in quantity and quality of high school diplomas. Today, we're ranked 36th in the world. 97% of low-income students here rely on school for internet access. 40 million students do not have high-speed internet in school at all. And then on top of this, they're not having high-speed internet at their homes. 45% of Americans have no access to public transportation, which we've talked about before. And the U.S. is the eighth largest polluter per capita in the world. The U.S. also has a higher mortality rate than comparable countries in terms of wealth and resources, and disease burden is higher in the U.S. than in comparable countries as well. The U.S. also ranks last in measure of healthcare access and quality, indicating higher rates of amenable mortality than peer countries, and maternal mortality rates in the U.S. have risen over time and are much higher than any peer countries as well. So at the end of the day, you know, we do have all these programs that need desperately to be funded. We have infrastructure that desperately needs to be repaired, and we keep getting told we don't have money to do this. We don't have money to do this. And we also have things that we're falling behind other countries in terms of, you know, universal healthcare, free college, and we're constantly told there's not enough money, and the most important thing in the world is balancing the budget, right? So then you have something like MMT, and you can see why it's appealing and it's attractive, because what if balancing the budget didn't matter at all? Like, it appears not to matter so much to Japan. What if instead we just spent the money we needed to make these things happen for us? At the end of the day, MMT might not be like the ultimate destination I would be heading towards, just because, you know, you start bringing in things like the minimum wage jobs for the workers, which that doesn't sound ideal, yeah. You know, and the increased emphasis still, not increased, but there's still the same emphasis on the private sector and private business, mm-hmm. which isn't necessarily something that I'm interested in because it's still capitalism, right?
Yeah.
But it does seem like something akin to the Keynesian model of introducing ways to regulate in order to make capitalism a little better for a while. MMT seems like that. It's like, here are some things we could do within capitalism to potentially increase people's quality of life and provide us with more social programs. So yeah. I think it seems more like that thing where it's a bust off you get off of that's a little closer to your end destination, mm-hmm. even if it doesn't get you all the way.
Yeah, for sure.
So what are your thoughts on all of this?
Yeah, I'm like, I keep thinking about like, well, what's just stopping this from happening? Because to me, it's just like, oh, well, it seems like if we're going to have this system that we're capitalisming in, then why not just do this? Because that sounds way better if you're going to keep like the majority of the system we have now. But I'm like, you know, like you've seen the signs on social media where it's like, no one came to work today at this Burger King and like stuff like that. It's like people who own companies, who own big corporations, who are actually like the, you know, people in power who give money to lobbyists and stuff like that. I think that they want, like, to me, it's like this system benefits like a few people in power. Maybe that's like, you know, tinfoil hat, but it's like, well, if you keep people with these like near starvation wages, they have to work for you, and therefore you get the money to give to yourself and your shareholders, and the less money you spend on labor.
Right. Like there's a different, more insidious reason than inflation that everybody's concerned.
Yeah. I feel like everyone's like inflation. And I'm like, I think it's like, it's deeper that like, it goes deeper. It goes to like, well, some people don't deserve things because they don't work hard enough, or like, I feel like it goes to like a weird, like more sinister, like cultural norms of like, people like should like have these like crummy jobs, or people should blah blah blah. Like, I don't know. That's, to me, it's like my brain is kind of running like a million miles an hour on this, but I feel like it's not just about inflation. There's some more, like there's a bunch of stuff like wrapped up in this.
Yeah, the thing that was interesting to me about the inflation thing is that all the people who like MMT are also like, yeah, inflation, that is a real thing that we consider deeply, and that's why we've structured tax policy into this to reflect more like ways to monitor and control for inflation. And that isn't that different than like how the Fed controls for inflation yeah. today. It's just, it manifests a little differently.
What about but to me, it's like, well, what about social programs? What about social policy? All you're doing is like finance policy. Mm-hmm. It's not, it's like, you know how they say like, you know, like when you're giving to charity or like donating, the actual best thing to do is just give people money and let them do whatever they want with it. And like that actually has like the best outcome.
Right.
This seems like there's so many steps in the way of just making sure everybody has everything they need. And it's a way to skirt certain government regulations. Like you could just have a government regulation that says no inflation.
Right.
You know, everyone gets a house. But they're like, no, we need to make it so there's no deflation so people can work and then blah, blah, blah. It's like, well, why not just give people houses and money?
Right.
It just seems like many steps in between. That would be my... I am not a smarty economist, but that would be my layperson, like, weirdo person critique of it, where it's like, well, why are there so many steps in between? But I do see that if we're having the system now, it is the stop, you know, like a stopgap measure.
Right. That's kind of how I think about it, too. I'm like, yeah, it's not ideal, but it does seem like something that could make all of this potentially a little more bearable mm-hmm. and give us the social programs that we're lacking, that other countries are able to develop yeah. just fine, that we're not able to. And I do think, like, there is some moralizing that comes with the idea of balancing the budget.
Yeah.
But it's weird because the people who I hear who are so preoccupied with balancing the budget, it tends to be fiscal conservatives, and yet fiscal conservatives are also the people continue to ask for these huge military budgets every mm-hmm. year. So I get where, kind of when I was doing this research, people were like, it's a politicized issue, the deficit. People don't actually care about the deficit, whether they're fiscally conservative or not, because if they actually cared about the deficit, they would be concerned about the overspending in the military, for example, mm-hmm. and all these other different places. But they're not. They don't want to take from that. You know, it just becomes this politicized rallying cry, and it almost gives us like political theater to watch the Republicans and the Democrats battle it out over the budget.
Yeah. And it, I've been like listening to a lot of stuff and reading a lot of stuff about how the news as entertainment, like the news,
yes.
like politics are like a hobby now. Like we watch it like we watch sports, like where it's like, but people aren't actually involved, if that makes any sense. Like they're like, ooh, what's going to happen with like Bernie and Mitch McConnell? Like what's going to go down? Instead of being like, oh, I'm actually invested in this policy and this policy and this policy because it, you know, this in my neighborhood, blah, 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 it affects me this way. People more see it as like entertainment. And I feel like the deficit is like, it's just like a talking point. It's not something that people like you said, like actually give a shit about.
Right. I can see that for sure. There is definitely like pageantry theater that comes to like the US's political system, mm-hmm. you know, and it definitely does become like a cult of personality. And it's interesting to me, you know, that here we have people like Bernie Sanders who, yeah, he's left leaning, but he's not like a communist or a socialist. Mm-hmm. And he's one of the people who's like modern monetary theory. And everyone's like, so it must be communism. And then you look at it, you know, me, I'm like, really? Is it communism? Is it communism? And I look and I'm like, this is not communism at all. This doesn't seem that different from what we're doing now. It seems totally easy to achieve. And it seems like it actually would probably make things slightly better. Yeah, but not like the overhaul that I would potentially want. But then, you know, when I hear myself say all those things all disappointed, I'm like, oh, it's hardly different at all. Why are people so opposed to this?
My other, like, you know, insidious feeling is that if people did, like, the reason why people don't want to do this, even though it could like in an instant like solve all the budget, like social programs, whatever, is because like there is like a huge swath of like, you know, Reagan conservatives who just like they don't want social programs at all.
Right.
And therefore, if you gave money for this, you would have to increase social programs.
Right. And it's less about like they don't want it, not because of the expense. The expense is irrelevant.
The expense is irrelevant.
It's like a weird moral high ground they're on that they don't want people to be helped.
Exactly. It's like the Ayn Rand
thing. Yes. It's like the how it's actually cheaper to give people houses thing.
It yeah. It's
comes
like
from the same thing.
Because to me, it's like, yeah, it's obviously cheaper to do the right thing and to help people. Why isn't it happening? And I'm like, oh, like I think that literally, like there's this huge, like, you know, it's about conservative swath where it's like, no social programs, like you pick yourself up by the bootstraps, like, which also, like, you could just go down into all the like patriarchy, like, you know, racism, eugenics, like all this more like insidious stuff on why we don't have social programs.
Right. It is. It's true that there's like also like an element of like that cowboy culture thing where mm-hmm. you're like, oh, you want your roads repaved? Like, why? That makes you weak.
Pave them yourself.
Pave them yourself.
Why don't you have a fucking horse and a truck? Like, remember that thing when there was that horrible like cold snap in Texas where there was like a yes. mayor of a small town who was like, if you, like, you're complaining about us fixing the power, well, you're weak. And if you can't survive this, like, you need to, like, fix this on your own. And it's like, why are you the mayor then?
Right. Yeah. It's like you're literally your job to provide for these people and make sure all these services are running. And people pay for them. People are paying for their water and power. It should function.
Yeah. It's just like, what the hell, man?
Yeah.
Like, it's like, okay, I haven't seen much of Parks and Rec, but you know how, like, the main Parks and Rec guy is, like, the boss is like, I don't believe in government, and that's why yes. I work for the government.
Because he's trying to waste the money all the time so that nothing actually gets done. Yeah, he's, like, a critique of a libertarian.
Yes. Yeah. Oh.
It's pretty funny. No, I think this is interesting because lots of people, though, are excited about modern monetary theory. And I was surprised when I did the research on it to actually find that it is not that extreme, and it is not that, to me, by my eyes, it's not that left-leaning. And you have all these people in pretty high up positions, like Alan Greenspan basically was like, yeah, that's real. That's true.
Yeah, who is not good at his job. From what I remember, he was the guy in charge during the financial crisis. I also believe that Alan Greenspan literally was friends with Ayn Rand.
Oh, that could be. That guy, he was very...
I would have not been in high school when this happened, but I do remember reading that and being like, damn.
Yeah, I think it's also interesting that there's, like, the Goldman Sachs people were like, yeah, this could just happen. You know what I mean? It's like, it's almost like a neoliberal kind of idea rather than, like, a leftist idea.
Yeah, and it's like, it's just... I've been weirdly thinking about that movie, The Big Short, and the book. It's very good.
I need
explaining
to watch.
The financial crisis, where you're basically like, so all of this is a fake casino where you can just make up rules and shit. And to me, like, the idea of modern monetary theory, like, if you're working in the system, is great, like, blah, blah, blah. And then I keep being like, but you're just making up all these rules anyway. Then
why not make up better rules?
Why not make up better rules, or why not get rid of the rules and just be like, however it needs to be done, we're going to give people money and houses.
Right. Just more direct action. I mean, definitely it's like the direct action thing is preferable to me, obviously, but I could see the appeal of modern monetary theory to like more people in the center to kind of drag them a little more left to be like, look at these things we can have. And it's hard. It's hard. It's like I've got mixed feelings, you know?
Yeah.
Because then you're thinking big picture, long term, what do you want? How does this play into it? And you're like, well, this is fine. It's not great, but it's fine. It'd be a little better maybe. But then you have short term. You're like, this seems actually pretty achievable and pretty easy to get people on board with. And I understand why people on the internet have been circulating this idea of modern monetary theory around, and they're excited about it. Like, it's not exciting to me because it doesn't address some of the main issues I see with capitalism, but it is a little better than what we have. And I can see how, yeah, if your primary goal is looking for ways to fund like repairs to infrastructure and solve unemployment, all of these things, I could see how this would be very exciting to you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's, you know, that's what I got on MMT, the mixed bag.
Yeah, and a $1 trillion coin heist.
Yeah, and you have the wallet that just opens, and every time you open it, there's $1 trillion coin inside. That's how I'm going to explain it to everybody from now on. So another thing I thought was interesting about all of this is you and I, Kenna, we were kids during the Clinton presidency. Do you remember about Bill Clinton balancing the budget?
I do. I remember this.
This was like his whole thing he campaigned on, and he managed to get the budget to have no deficit whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
So I was thinking about this, and I was wondering, like, how rare was that? And in fact, the last year that the United States had a balanced budget with no deficit was 2001 when he was in office.
Yeah, because I remember being in high school during the Iraq War, and they're like, now the deficit is this much. But it's okay, because George Bush.
Right, yeah. And I was thinking about that, and I'm like, well, did shit get really good when the budget was balanced? Was the country, like, bomb after that?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either. So I was looking it up, and what I found is that after the balanced budget, there was actually like a lot of people were like, wow, that kind of fucking sucked. So I want to talk about that just for a second, because I thought it was interesting. So basically, there's this economics professor, Stephanie Kelton, who has said, I think it's safe to say we are still suffering the harmful effects of the Clinton budget surpluses, because not only was it balanced, but the government had a slight surplus. So, you know, the formula to understand this is private consumption, which is just a fancy way of saying spending, and then like government spending, and then exports and imports. And that's like a trade surplus. We trade with other countries, right? So all of that goes together to create this formula of what our GDP is. And you know, during the Clinton years, we had this budget surplus affected by all of this. But if the government is in surplus, it means that the government's taking in more cash than it's spending, which is the opposite of stimulus, right? Like when the government was in deficit, we were getting stimulus as people, like mm-hmm. we were getting money in our pocket, right? So it's also well known that the U.S. trade deficit exploded during the late 90s. So there was a huge drag on the GDP during the Clinton administration as well. So the trade deficit was subtracting from GDP, and the government was sucking up more money from the private sector than it was pushing out. And there was only one sector of the economy left to compensate in this big complicated formula, right? And that was private consumption, or just like average people spending money, basically. But during all of this, the household savings rate collapsed during the Clinton years. Like, I'm looking at this chart here, and you can see it's been a slow, steady decline since 1987. And then it was pretty sharply low during 1999, 2000, and 2001. And then you also had household debt begin to climb. And household debt really started to climb a lot around 1993. But you see, you know, during the Clinton administration, it had like a little steep uptick now. And then you kind of start to understand that this didn't actually help the economy very much. Like, it kind of created like a weird crisis, and it became a drag on the economy. And households started spending and going into debt like never before. And this is interesting because I kind of feel like this is addressed in the MMT stuff a little bit, how we were talking about it, how they were like, a deficit can actually be a good thing, but because it means the government is investing back in the people. Whereas, you know, having a pretty balanced economy, actually, it ended up being oddly more bootstrappy, I think.
Yeah, I feel like all, like the Clinton presidency was basically, like, Republican, because it got rid of, like, a lot of social programs or changed.
Yeah, I remember he wasn't very progressive at all. I remember mm-hmm. he was very conservative. Yeah. And then like, I'm also reading like some analyses, you know, of the Clinton economic policy that did have this balanced budget. And yeah, a lot of economists are like, the surplus turned out to be a negative, like, it, you know, it's a joke. It's not like the money financially became a negative, but like the impact on our country became a negative. So then all these people who are advocating, like, we need to balance the budget, we need to get rid of the deficit, all of this, that's why people started asking, well, why? Like, what's the point? Despite budget surplus, interest rates were higher. The surplus provided no protection of the coming slump. And if anything, it weakened the most brittle part of the economy, which is households, which is just how much money the average person has in their savings, how comfortable they are. And this is kind of like a pattern of this. Japan, remember how we were just talking about Japan as a good example? Now it's like they run this huge deficit and they're doing great. Well, prior to this, they used to run a surplus, and they were running a surplus the year right before the economy went into terminal decline. And this is kind of why we see now, I think, that their focus has shifted so much onto mm-hmm. like the deficit is not the enemy. The deficit is not the problem. So I thought that was just like interesting, because I was remembering like, wow, wait, we have an example of this in our life. You know, the balanced budget, the balanced mm-hmm. budget. And it is interesting, one, that it was a Democrat who did it, right? Yeah. And that, two, the Republicans still use it as the rallying cry to balance the budget. But then you look and you're like, no Republican president has balanced the budget. And there's a reason. Maybe everyone knows it's actually not a very good idea.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just thought that was like a little interesting aside to throw in there about the Clinton years.
Yeah. Yeah, so interesting. It's still so funny to me that people just can't wrap their brains around. If you give people money, they'll do good stuff with it.
Yeah, yeah, I know. It all comes down to the same. Just like give people the resources they need, and that's fine.
I mean, if we're gonna use money, like, just give it to people.
Yeah, for sure. I wonder if, okay, this is something I've been thinking about. I wonder what you think. Like, I feel like more people will be on board with UBI, universal basic income, after experiencing the stimulus checks during COVID. Mm-hmm. Because I think maybe people have seen the impact it can have in your life. I know just from my perspective at work, like, business was booming after people got their first stimulus checks.
Yeah.
People had money. They could spend money.
Yeah. I definitely think that, yeah, like, if we're going to use money, like, it's like absolute must for people to have money. My only concern about UBI is people think that it is a replacement for social programs. Like, oh, you just give people money, but you don't have to give them health care. or housing, because they'll use them. Like, I think that's like the critique of like Andrew Yang.
Oh, interesting.
You know, the UBI guy.
Yeah, I don't actually know much about Andrew Yang.
I don't know a lot too. I just know that this is one of his critiques, because it's like, well, you need the money and you need the social programs, but on your own as an individual, it's too cost prohibitive to afford it on your own. That's why you have universal healthcare, universal social programs, because on our own, we just can't do it.
Well, and in addition, when you have like universal healthcare, it stabilizes the costs of things.
Exactly.
Because the private sector obviously has been price gouging in medical forever. Mm-hmm. And the private sector's biggest fear is that we would have universal healthcare, because then the government would have a say in how much medications and procedures would cost. Mm-hmm. And that would be kind of stabilizing. They wouldn't be allowed to just overnight artificially inflate the prices of whatever drugs they want, because they know people have no choice but to pay them or they'll die.
Yeah.
So we see that being like an influence too. So yeah, I don't know. I think the UBI thing is really interesting too. It almost seems like MMT is UBI for the government.
Yeah.
Look at all the letters they threw in there too.
Oh my gosh. It sounds like you're trying to sell me something to put in my bulletproof coffee.
Oh, does it? Maybe we throw MLM in there too. Increasingly, I'm feeling like the government is just a multi-level marketing scheme.
Oh my God. I think about this.
Yeah. Another thing I think about too is how real estate is a multi-level marketing scheme. And this is a tangent, but if we're talking about acronyms and analogies, for a while I got really interested in real estate. And I was like, okay, I want to learn how real estate works. I'm going to go take real estate classes. So I took these classes and I kind of learned about how it worked. And I was like, oh, this is interesting, you know. And then I realized that, okay, if you want to be a real estate agent, you need to work for an existing real estate agent. And that existing real estate agent can only work under a broker. And like the broker is in charge of all of the real estate agents, and the real estate agents all train their little junior agents or whatever. But if the junior agent like sells a house or something, their big boss agent gets a cut of that. And then the broker gets a cut of that too. And I was like, oh,
it's MLM.
It's a pyramid scheme. Oh my God. Also, the place where I was taking the classes, I started to notice they had like a lot of Landmark stuff up around, which would be an interesting episode on its own.
I don't know what Landmark is.
Oh, Landmark is like a self-help group. But it's been banned in lots of countries for being a cult.
Oh, is it? Oh, so it's like Nexium.
It's kind of like Nexium, but people in the U.S., it's still legal here. However, France, I believe, banned it for being a cult. And somebody in France made a whole documentary about it.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So Landmark, they like market themselves here by offering like professional services to entrepreneurs to like help you get your life back on track. But I've had friends who their bosses made them go to Landmark.
Whoa.
Yeah. And one of my friends, they like locked her in a room. And when they locked the doors in this like conference room for this thing, she had no idea what it even was. Her boss just told her she had to go. And they like confiscated all their cell phones. She freaked out and just started screaming, "It's a cult!" And then like ran to the doors and was pulling the doors, and they were shaking because they were locked. And she's like, "Let me out!" And she made such a scene and was yelling, "It's a cult," that they had to let her out, or everybody in the place would realize it was a weird cult. Oh. I guess. So they gave her phone, whatever. And I think they'll probably sue me. Landmark will, if they hear me explicitly say Landmark is a cult. So just for clarity, I am not saying Landmark is a cult. I am saying some countries have not allowed them to function because the countries believed they were a cult. I feel like I covered my bases pretty well there. Do you think so? Yeah.
We're not saying anything. What the other people have said.
Nothing about, I'm just reporting what other people have said about Landmark, which is definitely not a cult.
We're not saying nothing.
Nothing. Nothing about Landmark. Anyway. So everything's a multi-level marketing scheme.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I did like the going back and just reassessing like what a balanced budget actually ever did for us. And the answer is not much.
Yep.
Thanks so much for listening to another episode of Pick Me Up, I'm Scared. If you would like to support us on Patreon, we are there, patreon.com/pickmeupimscared. For $2, you can get access to some bonus content, as well as a link where you can leave us voice messages, and we will talk to you. We will play the messages, give you advice, give you feedback, just say hello, whatever your heart desires, maybe, probably. And if you don't want to spend the $2 on a Patreon, that is totally fine. We are just grateful you're here.